A bottle full of pills. I started sleeping rough in parks, under bushes, on benches in my old neighborhood. My whole social web was destroyed by the murder case. I went to Olive's new apartment periodically, but she banned me from her couch after a while. Something that had never happened before. I understood. She didn't want me around because of the mayhem I'd been involved in, and she had to protect her family. It became clear, too, that Tim had a score to settle with me. "Where's my bloody leather jacket?" he'd yell, his fists held aloft ready to strike me. "Ask your friends, the cops, where the fuck my jacket is." I never did find out why the cops confiscated his jacket, or if they returned it later. I ventured over to Mississauga and began using the Salvation Army shelter there. It was way back in the industrial section of town, at least 3 hours away by bus from my usual stomping grounds. I stayed for a month but felt isolated, so I went back to Brampton. But I still couldn't go back to the Brampton shelter. I'd blown welfare startup money after the preliminary hearing. One night, around midnight, drunk and high, I ventured to Leroy's parents' house. His father and mother had welcomed him home after Vancouver and forgave him. It was like return of the prodigal son. Sylvia had long since gotten married and started a family of her own, working as a special needs teacher. She'd really come full circle from the Sylvia I remembered in grade school. I banged on the window. No Leroy. I pounded on the door and hollered and heard his barking dog. Still no Leroy. I'd watched him jimmy open his bedroom window in the basement before, so I crawled down into the window well and pushed the glass up and over to the left in spurts. It popped right open. I poked my head in and yelled his name. The dog rushed over barking. I dropped down into the room, rubbed the dog's head, wandered to the kitchen to make myself a snack, and started watching some TV in his bedroom. The phone rang, which startled me. Then it hit me. I'd broken into my best friend's house. I'd violated his space, our friendship, his family. It was much worse than me leaving him in Vancouver. I got up, locked the door behind me, and went into his garage and fell asleep on a pile of wood. When I awoke, Leroy was standing over me. "You broke into my house?" I leaned back against the wall, my legs slipping on a log. "You crossed the fucking line this time." "I'm sorry. I didn't have anywhere to go. I didn't steal anything." "Fuck, man," he said. But then the expression on his face changed. "You can stay here if you want." His pity wounded me, made me feel inferior. I told him I was sorry again and scurried away. I slept behind the arena attached to the school where I'd gone to junior high, across the way from where we'd smoked our first cigarettes together. I felt like Leroy was avoiding me. I'd lost my best friend. I figured people would say I was out to rob him blind. Maybe it was payback for Vancouver. Whatever the reasons. Without my best friend in my corner, I had nothing. I was distraught about everything. The case, being a social outcast, being homeless and hopeless. I went to a drugstore and stole a bottle of 100 acetaminophen tablets and ate them all before I could think better of it. Then I went and sat by the river with my feet in the water, the rush cool against my skin. My toes numbed as I wiggled them in my shoes. A roar filled my ears, like an approaching hurricane. I checked the treetops and the leaves were still. There was no breeze. Stretched thin and sapped of energy, my vision crowded black at the sides, then formed into deep tunnels. I stood up, but my legs had a hard time holding my weight. I wobbled along the pathway, grabbing branches as I fell down to my knees. I hoisted myself up again using the edge of the garbage bin and attempted to breathe deeply, but no amount of air could fill my lungs. They gurgled and filled with fluid. My heart beat faster than if I'd run a marathon at full sprint. I was dying. I panicked and walked the half mile it took to get to the hospital. I glanced in the glass before the emergency doors slid open and I saw myself. Deep-set charcoal eyes, plastic-looking skin. I looked like a gray alien. I swallowed a bottle of Tylenol, I said to the nurse at the desk. An hour ago. Without a word, she ran into the back and a team of orderlies came out and put me on a gurney. I gave them Olive's phone number and then my world went white. My eyes cracked open. I was in a room, strapped onto a bed, with doctors and nurses buzzing around. I heard a beeping and a sound like Darth Vader next to me. There was a mask strapped over my face and I called out, Grandma, but heard nothing. The neon lights above captivated me. The doctors kept running around. I coughed. Breathing was even more labored now. My head felt thinner, the ringing louder, the wind roaring through me, carrying me away. A doctor appeared, ripped off the mask, and jammed a tube down my throat. I watched as black fluid crept down the tube and filled my belly, then spilled out of my mouth, down my neck, and all over my blue gown. Then lights, more doctors rushing, and silence. Wake up, someone said. Their breath smelled like onions. Whoever it was peeled my eyes open and a light blinded me. I tried to look away. Hello, another said. Mr. Thistle, Jesse? I tried to respond, but the tube made it hard to speak. Then silence again. When I finally came to, I was in a room with a guard. I was told that was so I wouldn't run away or hurt myself. Apparently, I'd woken up earlier and ripped the tubes right out of my body, undid the straps, and took off. The hospital rang the local police precinct and put out an APB on me. I couldn't remember if the police brought me back or if I'd wandered back myself. Rest easy, the guard said. The doctors will be by shortly. He looked familiar and told me we'd played together as kids way back in grade school. We used to scrap. But that school was nuts back then. I laughed. I remembered him stomping me for playground supremacy. He'd been in one of the rival gangs. You've had a rough go of it, eh? He said. I broke down. When the doctor showed up, she informed me that I'd taken a lethal dose of slow-release acetaminophen. It's one of the hardest overdoses to treat. It releases acetaminophen at a steady rate. We try to treat it with liquid charcoal, which absorbs toxic substances, but you may still have a number of pills lodged in your digestive tract and so are very much at risk. Any more time and your liver would have been destroyed. Did you hear a roaring wind? Yes. That's how thin your blood was pumping over your eardrums. I had to explain to a psychiatrist that I'd meant to end my life, but I now wanted to live. Why did you do it? He asked. I destroyed a lifelong friendship, and I don't have anywhere to go. I just can't stop fucking up. It's more common than you know. He filled in a form, told me I needed rest, and decided to hold me for at least another week. I'd already been under observation for 72 hours. I gave the attendants the phone numbers of everyone I knew. Leroy, my grandparents, Olive, Jerry, and Josh. Only my brothers called to see if I was okay. No one came to see me except a friend of Olive's who'd let me crash on his couch from time to time. He gave me some money so I could take the bus to Jerry's new place. Smitten. When my strength was up after the overdose, I got a job at a local grocery store near Jerry's as a produce clerk, stacking fruit, cutting lettuce, crushing boxes. Josh sent $1,000 to help me get on my feet. I love you, he said on the phone. We all do. Just don't kill yourself. I kept chasing death, though. Each time I got a paycheck, I went out and spent it on comfort for my mind. I started banging needles of crack melted down with vinegar with working girls in the train yard at Dufferin and Queen across from Toronto's Gladstone Hotel. They didn't judge me, and there was an honesty to what they did, like they had the courage to take things all the way. I had respect for that. There is perfect order in perfect chaos, I philosophized. We'd shoot up in the abandoned trailer one of the ladies lived in. I brought food from work sometimes, and we'd listen to Charlie Parker or Velvet Underground or some other brilliant junkie band. They were my friends, my only friends. One morning while I was stacking apples, my boss, an old Italian guy, glanced down and saw the bruising on my arms and my track marks. "You know, Jess, there's no shame in being sick," he said. But he was polite enough not to say anything outright. I knew he couldn't complain about my work performance. I worked hard and got the job done, just like Grandpa had trained me to do. Sometime later, I saw a crisis support line number scrawled on the job chalkboard. I called, but the addictions worker told me, "You need 3 months or more before your employee insurance kicks in." I wasn't surprised. I tried accessing treatment before many times, but the places all had long waiting lists or needed insurance or were outpatient only. There was always some kind of restriction. Detox worked, sure, but after that I'd be left with nowhere to transition to and would relapse. I knew I needed quick isolation to get clean, total immediate immersion for months and months. My addictions had become unmanageable. I couldn't escape the horror of being involved with people who'd taken someone's life in such a gruesome way. And I had recurring nightmares of that jersey melting into my body, of being stabbed in the neck, of people lying in wait to ambush me around every corner. With rent squirted up my veins, I ran away, leaving Jerry and my boss high and dry. I fled to the Brampton shelter and, to my surprise, met the most beautiful girl. She was just sitting there, surrounded by a pile of plastic bags and suitcases. Her hair was blonde and pulled back into a tight ponytail that lifted her eyebrows up, and she was well taken care of. I went to the washroom to comb my hair and straighten my shirt, and then went over to her. "I'm Jessie," I said, holding out a cigarette. "You smoke?" She smiled and took it. Her name was Samantha. She placed her bags near the front door and asked the staff to watch them. Then we went outside to the smoking pit. Straight away, I knew she was fearless and powerful, like a lone she-wolf who didn't need help fending for herself. She had no problem talking about how she'd ended up at the shelter. Her parents had kicked her out because she was an independent thinker and she'd lost her job at the local gym. "They're very Christian," she said. "Not me. I love to party." For 2.5 months, we tripped around, getting high, staying on people's couches, then decided to combine our welfare startups and leave the shelter. We finally got a place and began picking trash to furnish it. She didn't mind, and even brought stuff home herself, an old couch, chairs, a microwave, and a TV. Uncle Ron saw that we were trying and got me a job building countertops. I still took off on paydays trying to numb myself out, but now Samantha blasted stones right by my side. We're like two quarry workers chucking dynamite and smashing crack boulders together. I ghosted work so often that the owner of the business, Randolph, changed paydays from Thursday to Friday just so I'd make it into work on Friday mornings. I worked my ass off, though, doing the job of four men. Made sense. I was jacked on cocaine and moved faster than Ben Johnson at the Seoul Olympics. Randolph ended up firing me, furious because I was so unreliable. But as soon as he axed me, he'd hire me right back. He knew no one could work like me. I was probably fired and rehired over 20 times. Samantha and I soon lost our place and started moving constantly, gathering household belongings and then jettisoning them like spent rocket fuel containers whenever we missed rent and entered homeless orbit. We must have moved about 30 times. Everything I pulled in at various temp jobs went to feed our addictions, to keep those nightmares at bay, and we always ended up at another shelter in another city or at Jerry's. He always had his door open, and Samantha and I were thankful, but I could tell he was reaching his limit. In between checks, food banks, and jobs was the hardest. We'd have no food, no alcohol, no fun, and no hope. I began stealing ground pork and ramen noodles at a market over in Chinatown. I did it at least a dozen times, stuffing my backpack and booking it out the front doors, until one day, a security guard stopped me. I broke free and ran, but was headed off. Security brought me to the back room. I shouted and fought, but the security guard restrained me, pushing me to the ground and holding me tight with my arms behind my back. I was sure they would call the cops and that I'd go to jail on a theft under 5,000 charge, the standard Canadian charge for shoplifting. I sat weeping, and when my energy was spent, the owner came in. "Why you steal from here all the time?" she said with a thick Cantonese accent. "Go steal somewhere else, bad boy." "Bad boy," I thought, thinking that was kind of demeaning and strange. She was right, though. I always chose her store. It was big, and I believed its size concealed me. Obviously not. "I know the other owners," she said. "They see you too." Her neck turned red as she flailed her arms. "I'm sorry, miss, I know you, crackhead." Her voice made me feel ashamed. "I see you steal ginseng and steel wool for your pipe." She wagged her finger, a look of disgust on her face. How did she know about that, or where I got my gear, I wondered, shocked. Had she seen me steal it from the local convenience stores? Did she know all the local merchants? She pulled up my chin and forced eye contact. "Too skinny," she said, then slapped my cheek, but not with anger. It was like she was sorry for me. "Look at you, too skinny." She took my backpack and opened it. "You have my pork and noodles." She shook her head. I felt like an idiot. She motioned to the security guard and the few employees who were there to leave the room. When we were alone, she squatted next to me. "I was hungry a long time ago too, you know," she said. "Someone fed me too." She got up and went over to a skid and grabbed some noodles and yelled something. A man came through a plastic flap door with a big clear grocery bag of ground pork. He handed it to her, looked at me, then left. She stuffed both the noodles and meat into my bag and plopped it into my lap. "Now go, and don't ever come back." She stood me up and then shooed me out the back door before I could thank her. I never stole from there again. Everywhere else was fair game, though. Thieving was the one thing I was good at, that Samantha and I could count on. I grabbed whatever she wanted, meat, alcohol, smokes, the odd article of clothing. I was smitten with her, and it was my selfish way of keeping her by my side. Maybe I should have let her go and let her be. The King of Somalia. "Good night, Abdi, you crusty old bastard," I said and rested my head on my pillow. Abdi was a Somali man of about 65. He was my buddy and always slept in the bed next to me at the homeless shelter. Samantha was off on the woman's side. "Hey," I said a minute later, "I've been meaning to ask you. You said you were the king of Somalia. Is that true?" As expected, Abdi's face flushed and his eyes bulged. "Would I lie, peasant? Of course I am the king of Somalia. How dare you question my royal blood?" Obviously, I knew he wasn't Somali royalty. I liked joking with Abdi to get him going, and he'd do the same with me. It was our only form of entertainment in this hospitable, yet horrible place. Life hadn't been good to Abdi. He'd fled Somalia with his family when civil war broke out in the early 90s. Soon after, he'd become an alcoholic and his wife had left him for another man. Abdi would reminisce about his homeland, telling me how he used to shepherd massive herds of cattle between Kenya and Somalia, and how he'd sit every night watching the orange-red African sunset. By the way his eyes lit up, I could see it was something he missed dearly. I tried to imagine how hard it must have been for him to be forced out of his homeland, to end up in a homeless shelter in a foreign country that seemingly didn't want him or his problems. "Hey, Thistle," Abdi said as he leaned over. "You know how I know you're a real streeter like me? Maybe it's in the way I drink the last of the old English piss water?" He cringed. "No, that's just disgusting. Dirty Canadian drinking dirty American beer. No, young blood, it's in the way you sleep." "How do you mean? And why are you watching me while I sleep?" "I always watch out for you when you sleep, to make sure no one steals your stuff." I thought about it, and he was right. I watched out for him, too. It was just what friends did in this place. Indian, you've had your shoes stolen so many times, you sleep with them on, see? He pulled up his blanket, exposing his grungy, mud-covered black boots, and smiled. You see those young guys? Abdi pointed to two men with their shoes placed under their cots. They're little puppies, down on their luck momentarily. One day, if they're at it long enough, they'll learn like we did, never take your shoes off. Having no shoes and being homeless was the worst. It could take a day or two to find a new pair that fit from the donation box, and that was if you were lucky. Other times you'd have to leave the shelter shoeless at 7 a.m. to go and wait at the chaplain's office until 8 a.m. to get a voucher to take to the Sally Ann up the street so they could outfit you with a new pair. Or you had to go without for a few days, or steal a pair from Zellers and risk your freedom. When you were shoeless in winter, it was almost unbearable. I surveyed the shelter beds. Only about a third of the guys had their shoes on. I'd never noticed, but every night I tied my shoes on with triple, even quadruple knots, just to give myself a chance of keeping thieves from stealing them from right off my feet. Even then they got them sometimes. I guess I do sleep with my shoes on, eh, Abdi? I said and laughed. Life at gunpoint. Flip's .38 was pressed hard into my forehead. Flip was one of the more aggressive and secretive crack dealers who served the downtown core. He'd been doing it for decades and was a wild card, trigger-happy too, and even the rival gangs let him chop uncontested. I didn't like going to him. No one did as far as I knew. But he always had good dope at all hours and was one of the only choppers who'd exchange goods for crack at a fair price. I was hoping he'd buy the Gucci bag I'd just stolen from a car with my high school friend Marco, but, in desperation, nobody else had dope. I disregarded the various rules Flip put in place to protect himself from crackheads he didn't know. His number one rule? No new customers. His number two rule, no new customers, and so on. I thought our long-standing relationship might supersede the formalities. Marco kept bugging me to sell the bag, and thought maybe our friendship was good enough to get him access to Flip.
Who's this fool you brought here?
I told you not to bring anyone to see me. Spit and angry breath hissed through Flip's clenched teeth as the hammer cocked into firing position.
That's my boy. Come on, dog. I've known you for years.
We only wanted to score some dope, and Flip was flipping out. Just then, a cruiser rounded the corner. In an instant, Flip rammed his pistol through his belt, pointed his finger at me, mouthed something, and fled down the street towards the Dairy Queen. He was gone before I could process what happened.
Man, I'm sorry, guy. Marco said. I never thought your buddy would react like that. What is his problem?
I looked at Marco. His astonished words told me he didn't really understand how close I'd come to death. A week after, the pinkish-purple imprint of the gun muzzle, the size and shape of a lifesaver's, remained engraved between my eyes. I never did another run with Marco again. We all fall down. The Halloween party at Jerry's friend's house ran late into the night. I was dressed up as William Wallace from Braveheart, half my face blue with a diaper of fake fur and a plastic sword. Jerry was a Viking with huge horns and a plastic battle axe, and Samantha was the picked girl from King Arthur, with leather armor and a bow and arrow made from household items. The rest of the partygoers wore costumes ranging from ghost to Spanish matadors, but a couple of people were dressed in regular clothes. One was a beautiful redhead in a tight black sweater. She was the girl from grade school who'd been nice to me on the hill.
Hi, I said to her. My name's Jesse. You're Lucy, right?
I stuck my hand out like I had years earlier. Yes, she reciprocated, like she had years before. Do you remember me? I'm Jerry's brother. We're in middle school together. I motioned towards Jerry, who was chatting over near the kitchen. No, she grinned, shrugged, and then turned away to talk to a bald guy. Samantha came up with her bow drawn, half drunk. I disarmed her, and we mingled into the heart of the party, asking people if they had any coke, but I kept looking back. I was enchanted by Lucy, and the fact that she wasn't interested attracted me even more. After a couple screwdrivers, I was hit with addiction craving so bad I ran to the toilet. I needed to take a dump. Then I ditched the party and Samantha and went out scouring for a 20 stone. I found plenty, spending our rent money and shoplifting things to generate more cash. Before I knew it, it was 4 a.m. I drifted back to the party, but almost everyone had left. One of the last people trailing out told me to get home quickly because Samantha was livid. I did my last toke and walked back to Jerry's, which was miles away. When I got there, I picked the outside lock with my health card. I didn't have my own keys, Jerry's rules. Even though Samantha and I'd been staying with him for months at his new place in Toronto after we'd fled from Brampton. The inside door to the apartment was locked. It was steel, bolted shut, and impossible to bypass with any of my thieving skills. I banged on it. It's me! Open up! Nothing. I banged some more. Again, nothing. I started kicking the door, the boom echoing through the hallway, and a neighbor stuck his head out of his door and said, "Keep it down." I kicked the door again. I wondered if Samantha was being faithful to me. Why would she be? I was a terrible provider. I didn't treat her the best. Maybe she and Jerry are inside having sex. Maybe she's exacting revenge on me for stealing our rent, for smoking it. Or maybe it was just the copious amount of crack that was making me paranoid. I noticed the window down the hall. It was about 3 feet wide by 4 feet tall and open onto the street. I went and stuck my head out of it. Our living room window was about 10 feet over to the right. It was open, almost begging me to climb over. I decided to go for it. After all, I'd scaled up the side of apartment buildings before, and this shimmy between windows was only 35 feet above the ground. Piece of cake. I charted out my climb. I'd swing from the ledge of the hallway window over to the brick notch between the two windows, where there was a good grip, then swing over to our window and plant my toe, and then pull myself up. I lowered myself out, swung over, grabbed the notch, then swung over again and grabbed the window ledge. Perfect so far. I took a second to collect myself for the pull into the apartment. Scar, Jerry's dog, a pit bull Rottweiler mix, stuck his head out and started licking my hands. "Git, git," I shooed. The fucker was blocking my entrance. He didn't budge. He must have thought I was playing a game or something. A drop of his saliva fell off his tongue and into my eye. "Scar, get!" I blinked to clear my sight. My strength was fading, my fingers slipping. I yelled, "Get!" one more time, desperately, and he finally listened. I hoisted myself a quarter of the way up and planted my toe against the wall and pushed, but slipped. I was still hanging on, but barely, my arms carrying my full weight. I examined the wall closely and noticed a cluster of black cables. Rows of them, one over the other, stapled to the bricks. I hadn't seen them in the dark. I mustered my last bit of strength to pull myself up towards the window, planting my toe higher than before, but there was another cluster of cables. My toe slipped, my hands let go. People who say your life flashes before your eyes when you're about to die are full of shit. What does happen is your world slows down. Seconds feel like hours. The sounds all around become clearer. Colors and lights become so bright you can see everything. Every bug and creepy crawly thing in existence. The milliseconds I was falling to my death, I thought of 100 different ways to fall so I wouldn't die. I could try to land square on my feet like I was doing a power lift. but my face and skull would be ruined as I fell forward into the brick wall with thousands of pounds of force. I could try to do a commando combat roll off to the side, but would hit the air conditioner and break my neck. Or I could try to catch the ledge of the window below. I tried that, but this wasn't Die Hard, and I wasn't Bruce Willis. My last option was to do a break fall, something I'd learned in judo as a kid. Land on my feet, tip backwards onto my back, and then slap my arms straight out and let the force ride out my bone structure, out my shoulders, humerus, radius, and ulna, and blow out through the constellation of wrist bones, and finally the fine bones of my hands and digits. That was the only way to stop from smashing my head like a watermelon. Every other scenario ended with brain trauma. It was my only chance. When my feet hit the ground, I leaned back. A wave of pressure fired down my arms, followed by two loud cracks that sounded like gunshots. I rolled onto the arc of my spine and saw my feet jut above me, and the back of my head lightly hit the sidewalk. Tink! The wind completely knocked out of me. I wasn't in pain, but tried to scream. Nothing came out. I looked at my hands. They were folded in upon my forearms. I tried to wiggle my fingers. They didn't move. I held up both legs and saw my right heel was in the middle of my shin and my right foot pointed backwards. The other foot and my skull were fine. Scar was looking out the window. He howled. I managed to pull in a lungful of air and yelled, "Help! Help! I've fallen!" Nobody came. I yelled three more times. Cricket. I shifted my strategy. "Fire! There's a fire!" From every direction, people came in seconds flat. I asked one guy to call my brother and tell him that I needed help. Moments later, Jerry was downstairs. "Jerry, I broke my leg and my wrist. I need you to call an ambulance." Jerry just scratched his head, disappeared, and then reappeared with an old set of crutches he had. "Here." He threw the crutches at me. "I don't need this shit. I have work in the morning." He turned and walked away. In shock, I managed to get up using the crutches and hobbled up three flights of stairs into the apartment. I never wished more that Jerry's building had an elevator. I was still not in any pain somehow. Samantha came out of her room. "What's going on?" she said, half asleep, shielding her eyes from the light. She grumbled and swore, and I heard the word asshole, and then she went back to bed. I grabbed the phone, my hands flopping about, and tapped 911 with the meat of my palm. The paramedics were confounded that I'd survived. This isn't Hollywood. 35 feet spells death most times. The pain was finally hitting me, like molten nails driven into my leg, over and over again. They laid me on the ground and told me not to move because I likely had internal bleeding. "You should have stayed where you fell. You probably have a broken back or neck." One of them turned to Jerry, who stood watching from the bathroom, and asked, "How did he get up here?" Jerry was silent. "I used the crutches," I yelped. They turned to me, mouths open. They jabbed something in my leg, strapped me to a plank-like stretcher, and carried me down to the ambulance, where they placed me on another, softer stretcher. On the way to the hospital, one guy kept cracking jokes to me, even though I was so tired. I just wanted to go to sleep, and then said, "When you get out, you really should leave those people. They aren't good." I felt a slap on my face and saw tubes sticking in my arms and hands. The lights returned to normal, and I felt a sudden warm rush, a fuzzy feeling. I knew it was some kind of opioid. I felt safe. A doctor appeared by my side as they ran with me down a hall. "What do you call a guy who fell out of a building and survived?" He cracked a smile.
"I don't know."
You call him you. I laughed, but my back and neck hurt. My foot and wrists pulsed with such sharp pain that the dull ache radiating from my forearms and shins was manageable. The doctor flashed a light in my eyes. I could feel someone cutting off my clothes, and then I was rolled onto my side and a wet, cold sensation slammed into my asshole. It bloody hurt, sharp with immense pressure, like a jagged chili fart scraping my lower intestines.
You aren't even going to buy me flowers, I remarked, as high as Lou Reed in 1967. The doctor laughed and said he'd take me to dinner when I recovered.
I like steak.
You're in good spirits. Just hang in there. He moved the object around inside my anus, then said something to the others around me. There were flashing lights. A giant white machine rotated up and down my body and over my head, and then blackness. I drifted upon a cloud afterwards. Doctors and nurses came in, filled me with fluids, told me I was lucky, and to cool it on the morphine drip. Got me to sign forms, and then, before I knew it, I was rushed into surgery. When I awoke in the recovery room, Samantha and Jerry were there by my side, apologizing that they hadn't known how serious the fall was. Samantha cried. I yelled at first, but then forgave them. They didn't know. I was the idiot who'd gone all strung out and drunk Spider-Man. The doctors told me that my fall shattered my right heel, destroyed my upper right ankle joint, broke my left wrist, and sprained my right wrist. I was told to keep my leg elevated. The surgeons decided it was best to leave my wrists exposed so I'd be able to walk with crutches. They said they'd fix my right heel and ankle with a 90-degree incision on the outside of my foot. It rode 6 inches along the back of my ankle and heel, and another 6 along the side of my foot. 2 pins protruded at the back of my heel, holding my heel and ankle together. They sent me home after 3 days. Scabs hadn't even formed. Western door. Scar sat beside me, nudging my arm every few minutes. He was my primary caregiver, along with Samantha. I lay in bed with my leg elevated, just like the doctor had told me to do. World War I documentaries rotated across the black and white TV, remnants of Remembrance Day programming. The horrendous 1916 battle at Verdun, with its massive craters and fractured trees, lacerated trenches, and knotted barbed wire, was the current feature. This has got to be the worst battle in history per square foot, I thought, as the narrator described the sheer number of deaths. It sounded worse than the Somme, and I wondered why we'd focus so much on the latter in grade school. I gazed down at the tips of my toes. They were red and the cast on my foot grew tighter and tighter. A strange itching had gnawed at my shin these past few days. I couldn't get to it, not even if I stuck a pencil down the cast. Almost like the itch was several layers below my skin in the marrow of the leg. A throbbing dull pain radiated up into my buttocks too, and even the Tylenol 4s I was prescribed couldn't stop it. When Samantha turned me over to clean me, she said that the back of my leg was turning a weird kind of gray, green almost, and was starting to emit an odd sweet smell. All I could keep down was chicken broth, the nausea was so bad. I thought it was the medication. I'd stopped shitting 5 days before and was sure I was bunged up from it. I found no relief from the chamomile and senna tea the doctor said would loosen my bowels. Only weed and hash seemed to make me regular and help with my appetite. But even that wasn't working anymore. The pile of cigarette butts in the ashtray beside me loomed ominously. I wasn't supposed to smoke, the doctor had warned. It impeded blood flow and increased the chances of infection. But I just couldn't stop cold turkey. I needed something to occupy the time. I took a handful of T4s before bed. I wanted to sleep all night for once. Scar and Samantha were beside me, and I knew Jerry would check up on me every few hours. It felt good to have my older brother watching out for me, despite our growing animosity. I entered the dead zone about 30 minutes after. My dreams came, as always. Bombs exploded near my head as I moved down the trench to deliver a vital message warning our men not to advance. A concussion knocked me into a puddle, and I dropped the letter as soldiers ran past to their deaths. I reached up towards their jackboots to stop them, but my fingers slid off their ankles. One young man looked down at me and startled me. He had dark features, a long braid, and bronze skin. He was an Indian and looked like me, but different, older, wiser. And I knew somehow he was already dead. He turned and disappeared into an explosion as he went over the top. The chatter of World War I artillery gave way to the slower, more powerful reports of a 19th century Gatling gun. But the hulking gun sounded more menacing, more real. There were houses burning all around, and children and women were screaming and running into the bush for cover. They were all native, like me. A handful of Indian men lay beside me in shallow pits, dug into the ground, long rifles in hand. We'd pop up periodically and fire down a large prairie slope at red coat soldiers near the banks of a large river. Our enemies stood in ordered columns and outnumbered us. The man beside me said something to me in a language I'd never heard before but understood, then reached over and took my last bullets. He cocked his rifle and returned our enemy's fire. He looked familiar, like the young man in the trench, and I could tell he was a half-breed like me. He, too, was dead. I somehow knew this. I looked back out of the pit and suddenly saw myself at the bed at Jerry's apartment. My body was broken, my leg propped up on pillows. Samantha, Jerry, and Scar weren't there anymore. I floated higher above the battle and saw a white church get smaller and smaller on the horizon of the plains, and I knew I was part of this long-ago battle. It was real. I saw my grandparents' house in Brampton and the house number 8 appear above the church. The number turned sideways and formed into an infinity symbol on a blue flag. I heard voices on the wind. They told me it was my destiny to be raised under that symbol. Just then, a great shaft of light from the west broke through the clouds. It was dusk and the orange light of twilight was fading fast. The guns and cannons fell silent. I saw a vast field before me with mesas and buttes off in the distance, and from the brightest spot of the setting sun, a vast herd of horses emerged and ran toward me. I watched their muscles ripple with power, their manes float on the wind as their heads bounded with each stride, and their hooves kicked up a cloud of dust so big it enveloped the whole earth. A tug, soft at first, then stronger and stronger, pulled me along with the herd as they ran by me and then back again. I was galloping with them, but I was not yet a hooved creature like them. I stared back and saw my broken body on the bed get smaller and smaller, until I could hardly see it. A great sadness came over me. I knew they were taking me home, but that I hadn't yet done what I was destined to do. I tried pulling away to return to myself, to my body, but the force of the herd was too powerful. I pleaded and cried, and still they pulled me with them. Just as I was about to cross into the brightest spot of the setting sun, through that western door, I cried out one last time. I will do my work, I will change, I will finish it. Without a sound, the herd pivoted and released me. I watched as they turned into the light, their hooves thundering, then fell behind the great facade of the western door. As soon as they were gone, my eyes opened. I was with Samantha on the bed. Scar tilted his head, and Jerry burst into the room. What the hell is going on? He asked, his voice shaking. You were screaming, help, help. I don't know what happened. I think I have a fever, I said, as I looked down and saw my body was covered in sweat. Samantha slept through it all. Cast of Horrors. When the doctor's assistant cut away the orange and black cast, she gasped. The smell was horrid, like Toronto during a summer garbage strike. Excuse me one moment, Mr. Thistle, I have to get the doctor, she said and rushed out. My toes had turned a bluish-gray-green, and the back of my cast was leaking a swampy crimson, so I pushed my post-surgery checkup ahead and was lucky to get a spot. It had been many weeks since my fall. The surgery should have worked, but I couldn't listen to the doctors. It's not like I didn't try to follow their orders. I did, but I was an addict. More importantly, I didn't have anywhere to live. I'd been at Jerry's, but after one of my friends stole a neighbor's vintage bicycle, he'd kicked me and Samantha out. He had to do what he had to do. If he'd have kept us, he'd have been evicted and we all would have been homeless. But I figure his place was probably where I caught the infection that I likely had. It was full of cat shit and dog piss and hadn't been cleaned properly in years. It was a veritable cesspool. Samantha and I moved into her parents' house. She got a good job. She was trying to fly straight. But I'd never really been welcome there, as we weren't married, and for a bunch of other reasons, so I took off on my own. I thought she could do better without me cramping her style. When the nurse came back in with the doctor, they both had masks on their faces. My stomach dropped. Their hands were full of instruments, including one that looked like wire cutters, lots of gauze, a kidney-shaped tray, and medical tape. When I finally got the courage to look down at my exposed leg, I nearly fainted. There was a black, pus-filled blister on the front of my ankle that resembled a giant, deformed pierogi. My foot and leg were swollen, green, red, and grayish-yellow. When the doctor took the staples out of the incision, the edge of the skin peeled back, exposing fat, muscle, bone, and metallic hardware. "Not good at all," the doctor said. "The surgery has been a complete failure. Your leg is infected and gangrene is setting in. I'll clean it, cut away the necrotic skin, and trim the bone, but you're at serious risk of losing your leg if you do not take care of yourself." He gave me something to freeze the area and set to work. Even with the numbing, when his full weight bore down on my leg and I heard the sharp, wet pop from the bone clipper, I bellowed, and tears began to stream down my face. As it went on, my field of vision narrowed to pinpoints, and my hearing dulled, and the voices around me became distant, then inaudible. I vomited, then passed out. When I woke up, my leg was again in a cast. I had on someone else's clothes and a numbness everywhere that smothered my arms and made my legs flop about. The nurse came in and told me I was free to go, but I had to speak to the doctor before I left. She had a prescription for antibiotics and a suction pump machine to attach to my leg to improve its circulation, as well as a schedule for an aftercare nurse who was to come and change my wound dressings twice a day. The doctor came in and asked me where I was staying. When I told him I was staying at the shelter, I could see his expression change. I knew it was a shithole of a place to recover in. I'd always been able to hold my own in the streets and in the shelter system, but I had to admit, things were not like before. And I knew I couldn't stay in the hospital. When the doctor and nurse left me alone a moment, I grabbed the pump and script and hobbled out, getting in a cab. The driver kicked me out halfway to my destination when he found out I didn't have the fare. The first night at the shelter, the pump disappeared. By the third and fourth nights, my prescription was stolen. A week into my stay, the infection was back. Not surprisingly, the nurse never came. When I had the pump and my meds, I could at least feel hopeful. I could at least dream of keeping my leg and walking on my own again. Now, I had nothing. I wanted to forget everything. I gave up. The personal needs allowance, PNA, I got every day at the shelter bought me my morning wake-and-bake hit of crack. That killed the pain in my leg long enough for me to make my way to the nearby drugstore where I could steal some mouthwash and razors. It was surprising how much crack you could get for a pack of triple razor blades and how stupefied a bottle of mouthwash could make you. Other homeless people I knew tried to help me. Some gave me free tokes of crack when the pain was unbearable. Others shared their liquor. Outreach people who knew me came by and gave me bus tickets, cigarettes, and a clean pair of socks. After they left, I broke down and cried. I couldn't even wear both socks. After about a week, I realized I couldn't feel my toes. They were cold and they had changed from grayish blue to waxy black. I hadn't noticed because I'd been too busy feeling sorry for myself. My toenails started to fall away at the slightest tug, and the skin sloughed off whenever I scraped it with my finger. It was happening, My foot was dying just like the doctor said would happen. I rushed myself to the hospital again. The doctor was furious. "Do you know how sick you've made yourself?" he yelled. The nurse rammed a thermometer in my ear. I knew I was sick. My upper leg and torso felt like they were on fire, and my head had been spinning for over a week. The doctor told me he didn't even have to cut the cast off. He could smell the damage I'd done to myself. "Mr. Thistle, based on your condition during your past visit and your condition today, I regret to inform you that we might have to amputate your leg. The infection is severe, and if it spreads to your brain or heart, it will kill you." His words thundered into my brain. "Like fuck you are!" The words came from somewhere deep within me. They were a knee-jerk reaction to an impossible proposition. They left the room to attend to someone else, and I frantically stumbled off the bed, mounted my crutches, and seesawed down the hospital corridor, tossing myself out the back door. Before I knew it, I was in the dorm room at the shelter. Not wasting any time, I packed what clothes I owned into a plastic bag, collected my PNA, and fled. I got to the subway and jumped on the train. The ride to the northern part of the city felt like an eternity. I clutched my Pyrex stem the whole way. It was loaded with crack I bought before I left the shelter with the hoard of bus tickets I'd got from the outreach workers and my $3.75 PNA. I had about a 50-piece. I promised myself I wouldn't smoke it until I got to Brampton. I needed to get as far away from the hospital and the threat of my leg being amputated as I could. Where I grew up seemed a safe and logical choice. Getting on the 77 bus was easy. It was something I used to do all the time. I'd just tell the driver I was homeless and needed to get to a shelter, and they let me on every time. Now I had a cast. How could anyone have said no? I slumped back in a seat, and we were soon cruising along the highway. When the bus started coasting through some of my old stomping grounds, a thought entered my head. We pulled into Bramley City Center, the air suspension hissing as the driver lowered the bus for me to get off. I hurried to catch the 1A bus to Four Corners, downtown Brampton. I had a plan. Turning point. Why the fuck am I wandering in the desert like a wounded animal? I asked myself as the 1A entered the terminal. "Last stop," the driver called out. The bus pulled to a halt, and I stepped off the platform and closer to relief. I lit my stem. The sizzle of the stone gave way to a milky stream of smoke that coated the back of my throat. A fire engine howled in my ear, and my heart raced. I found myself striding to a nearby convenience store. I knew what I had to do. It didn't matter that I'd never done anything like it before, or even wanted to. This was beyond wanting. This was need. Leftover crumbs that resembled bone shards peppered the center of my palm. With the tips of my fingers, I packed them into my pipe and lit it. My leg still hurt, but when I took this last blast, the pain completely subsided. I was ready. I gritted my teeth, opened the door, and walked in. It's too late to turn back now. There's nowhere left to go. I swallowed hard and grabbed the first thing in sight, a submarine sandwich wrapped in foil and a small jug of kitty litter. I brought both to the counter and waited until the clerk rang open the register, then made my move. "Give me all your money or I'll kill you," I yelled as I pointed my sub sandwich at the clerk. Lettuce and mayo flew everywhere. The guy looked at me with a half smirk. "Are you serious, pal?" A long, awkward silence ensued. At least it felt that way. "Of course I'm serious. Give me the cash and hurry the fuck up." I could hear my voice rising to a falsetto pitch, but I meant it. "Look, cowboy, I only have $90, store policy. You can take it. We're insured, so I really don't care. I just want to get home to my family. Understand?" I understood. He stepped aside. My hand jittered and rifled through the till, firing change and bills all over the place. My other hand squeezed my sandwich through my fist like beef through a meat grinder. Out of the corner of my eye, I could see the clerk picking up the phone. I scrambled and tried to bolt out the front door, but missed the handle and slammed headfirst into the glass.
Ah!
I yelled, clutching my head and dropping even more cash. A goose egg instantly formed. I almost passed out, but kept running.
You won't get far with that cast on your leg,
the clerk hollered as I rounded the corner. The cops are on their way right now. They'll get you soon enough. That was supposed to be the plan. Get arrested and go to jail, so I could get taken care of, so my foot could be fixed, and so my life would be saved. I was desperate. I didn't know what else to do anymore. I felt as though I had nowhere else to go, nowhere else to turn. But as soon as I was out of his sight, I jumped into the store's dumpster and covered myself in trash. I sat there, as frozen as a statue, for a good 4 hours, until the sounds of the police cruisers, helicopter, and dogs were gone. I was lucky, I guess. The juicy garbage must have masked my scent, and the police never even thought to look in the dumpster. I emerged as smelly as a New York City rat and counted my take. $37.20. I thought, this has got to be the worst moment of my life. Indestructible pink dress. I imagine cops everywhere, behind trees, under cars, behind doors, inside toilets, under the fridge, in my coffee. The sheer terror, the constant looking over my shoulder, was maddening. Drugs didn't help, and I couldn't bear the paranoia. I couldn't go back to Samantha and the little apartment she'd rented for us. I'd cleaned out her bank account, $400, while she was at work one day and blew it all on coke and booze, afraid of withdrawal after my Tylenol 4 prescription ran out and couldn't get it renewed because I'd gone through them too quickly. I wandered around feeling sorry for myself for about a week while my health deteriorated, when I should have worried instead about the damage I'd caused Samantha, how she'd eat and get to work for the next month. We'd gone through a lot of adventures together, living precariously in emergency shelters, in shitty rooms all over the city, on people's couches, and under constant threat of violence for a long time. It was the end of our 4-year relationship. I drifted in and out of shelters giving false names and slept on benches and in parks until one night, a dive bar let me use the phone, and I called the cops and told them I was the guy who committed the convenience store robbery in Brampton a few weeks earlier. I knew I'd be safer in jail than wandering around with no place to go. Society, I figured, cares more about criminals than they do about the homeless. They came and picked me up. The details of my arrest are sketchy at best. I remember the squad car ride to the station, how the officers were laughing at how bad I smelled, and the relief of knowing I was headed to jail, where I could rest and clean up and get some medical aid. I also remember the brief statement I made against myself. I did it, I said. Now lock me up and throw away the key. I just wanted a place to hide from the world. More than that, I wanted a place to crawl into and die in, like some wounded dog under a porch somewhere. They charged me with robbery and shipped me off to Maplehurst Correctional Complex in Milton to await my first court appearance. Upon arrival, I was processed, strip-searched, and clothed in an orange jumpsuit, then thrown in the general population bullpen with the other prisoners. I broke a jailhouse rule the instant I was caged. I whistled. 4 young guys jumped me from behind and stomped on my head until I was almost unconscious. I'm not sure why they stopped. There wasn't a guard in sight. Maybe they just ran out of energy. When a guard finally came to take us off to our individual pods, I told him I was suicidal and that I tried to swallow a plastic spoon near the toilet.
What happened to your face?
He asked with a smirk, spinning his keys on his finger. I fell over when I was taking a shit, I replied, my head throbbing. The guys in the bullpen laughed and confirmed my story when he asked for verification. They pulled me out of Gen Pop and stuck me in the protective custody holding cells, then processed me out to solitary confinement a few hours later. I came to realize solitary confinement, or the hole, usually isn't that bad a place to go while doing a short stretch of time. Sometimes prisoners earn their way there by beating someone senseless, or because they wouldn't squeal on their comrades, both commendable things inside. Sometimes those prisoners even got to wear their orange overalls down to the hole, and you could almost see the laurel wreaths on them as the guards paraded them past everybody. Not me. I went into solitary confinement because I'd been banged out of general population and then squawked on myself because I was suicidal. From that point on, I was marked as a bitch during my stay at the Milton Hilton, and I was always paranoid someone might find out I'd chirped on Mike and Stefan. To underscore my humiliation and horror, I was outfitted in an indestructible pink dress with no arms or legs, the standard garb given to prisoners on suicide watch. It was made from space-age padded polyester about 8 layers thick with diamond diagonal stitching and a collar wide enough to jam a pumpkin through, and it felt tougher than a bulletproof Kevlar vest. It was tearproof, so you couldn't rip it apart and make a braid to hang yourself with, which I tried to do. It resembled a loose miniskirt crossed with a tight poncho, and all the guys whistled when the guards walked me down to isolation. "Shake them fries, baby," one inmate called. "She's mine," called another, rattling the plexiglass on his cell door. The rest just blew me kisses and made hearts with their hands. I wasn't ready for this shit. Inside the hole, there was no blankets, no pillows, no contact, no respect. There was just me, my little pink dress, a blue jail-issue Bible, concrete, my thoughts, and time. Graffiti was scrawled all over the cinder block walls, lavish script done in the finest dried feces, blood, and pencil someone must have smuggled in their ass, addressed to God or Satan or other deities I wasn't familiar with. And, of course, there were pictures of giant penises and vaginas everywhere, decorated with old claw marks, broken fingernails, smears of snot, and magnificent pictures of the sun and trees for background effect. The first few days were excruciating. I entered withdrawal on day 2 with no medical support, no Librium or Valium or anything. I was getting antibiotics for my foot because I told them about it, but I was too whacked out to mention my addiction. Just my luck, I thought, as the furies of Hades engulfed and drowned my brown ass in the river Styx. Breathing was labored and almost impossible. Vomit and diarrhea fired out of me every 45 minutes or so. I never got to the toilet in time. My cell looked like it'd been peppered with a strange kind of mud, corn, and peanut shotgun. My bones sang shrill notes of agonizing pain that vibrated right down to the marrow, shattering and pulverizing my frame into piles of bloody talcum powder. Vivid colonies of maggots burrowed under my flesh and brain and hatched out of my skin into plump flies the size of raisins that clouded the neon lights that the guards never turned off. As I lay there, convulsing and wishing I would die, the soft voice of my cookum whispered gently in my ear. But her royal allowance song couldn't drive away the insects and demons. She was gone as soon as she came. I shook. I vibrated. I quaked. The horizon of the cell shifted up and down more violently, I imagined, than the crust of the earth during an earthquake. If the physical symptoms of alcohol delirium tremens just about killed me, the ever-increasing psychosis of withdrawal from crack broke me into shards of shame and pity and guilt that burned under my forehead like napalm watered with gasoline and lit by a blowtorch. The sharp edges of my memory stabbed into my consciousness, shredding my mind into fragile ribbons of dark introspection. Faces from the past, my grandmother, Mrs. R., the French teacher, Leroy, Karen, Ivan, the kid I robbed, Samantha. all came in like razor-edged knives to disembowel me on the altar of long-ago transgressions. "I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry," I pleaded. My eyes riveted shut, my tears run dry, my hands held aloft, trying to shield myself from a lifetime of mistakes. Dimensions folded in upon one another with the force that crumpled me in upon myself. I tried in vain to stop the implosion, to gather my intestines from the frozen cell floor, but the walls kept squeezing in and my guts wouldn't fit back into the empty cavity that was my existence. I writhed and squirmed, twisted and thrashed, and somewhere in my flailing, the side of my face chanced upon the only thing in the cell, the Bible. "Crater sends me a fucking message now," I sneered, pissed off by the timing. I snatched it up and hurled it at the wall. It bounced back and landed near my throbbing leg. It lay open to Psalm 32, but the words in the passage ran like black ants in all directions. I kicked it away. It landed near the base of my concrete bed. Pages splayed open once again, waiting. I never read the damn thing.
Solitary confinement. I dreamt I tread upon cobblestones of that ancient city, Jerusalem, where once David betrayed Uriah, his crown replaced by broken bones and sores, withered in iniquity. There upon marble floors he cried out, met by all he was, a coyote languishing in the land of jackals, Salah. Sharing the love. I finally sobered up, and within days the infection in my foot began to subside. I couldn't yet defend myself, so they put me in the protective custody wing where I could mend. Lauriston, my cellmate, was a man of 70 from Bermuda. He said he was in for probation violation, but I was skeptical. People in on breach never get more than 30 days. And here he apparently was with 2 years plus a day. Had he committed some heinous crime, or had he done just what he said he'd done? Was he just what he said he was? You could never trust other inmates. I also wondered how he had set up the sugar trade that had made him wealthy in packaged sugars. Each inmate only got one sugar packet on his breakfast tray, one for lunch for a tea, and one for dinner, again for tea. But Lauriston had a pillowcase full of sugar packets, and he consumed at least 5 of them at each meal. They were a real commodity in jail, and could buy food and help make mash liquor from orange peels, water, and bread, along with tobacco and dope. Mash was a top jail product. At mealtimes, the sugars would just pour into our cell. "Here, Lauriston," said Bucky, the quartermaster, the inmate who gives out and controls the food, the most powerful and respected position on the range, a collection of cells that form a holding area where inmates do the majority of their time. Lauriston reached both hands through the food port, and Bucky dropped a sock full of sugar packages into them. "Thanks, young blood. I have something for you. Hold up." Lauriston reached down into his dinner tray and handed Bucky his potatoes. Bucky dapped his fist on Lauriston's and thanked him for the carbs, much needed fuel, as Bucky worked out compulsively 3 hours a day. "I got you, Wisdom, always." Bucky smiled and continued distributing the rest of the trays to the other cells down the line. "You see that, Indian?" Lauriston said to me. "Give pon the next man, and the next man prosper with you." "It's a nice theory," I snapped. "But how do you know they won't just steal your stuff?" "What you thinking, fool? Wake up. We are people too, you know. We give and trust, just like all those people on the outside, like all those good people. Know this, all brethren who give to his brethren prosper by his brother, and all those selfish blood clot that don't get nothing but fire." Lauriston was quite angry,
It looked like he was going to start swinging. He kissed his teeth and muttered something, then became deadly serious. You see me? I'm an old man. I got no family, no drugs, no tobacco, no candy bars. I got nothing. But still, my canteens ran with goodies, and my belly full. These convicts can take anything from me, but I know to give, even in this place. And I trust these guys, and they know it. Some of them never been trusted in their whole lives. You know what that's worth in Babylon? I'm sorry, Lorston, I scurried to the back wall to get ready to defend myself. Calm your ass. I'd never hit a cripple. Listen to me. I'm trying to help you. Try it. Give away your food and don't ask for nothing. That means a lot in here. Trust those guys to be good people. But never give it to a bomba cloud who tries to take it. If that happens, then you beat his ass, life and death. I agreed to heed his advice and went to bed, all the while thinking about his pile of sugar. The next morning when Bucky came around, I took my breakfast tray, grabbed my cereal package and bag of milk, and handed it to Bucky. Here, take it, I said. Bucky just glanced at me, put them on his tray, and continued on. Nothing came back. I waited for an hour, looking over at him while he played cards with the other quartermaster priest. He didn't so much as peer up at me. What a prick, I thought. At lockout, I walked over to the shower, took off my overalls, and was about to get into the stall when Bucky came up to me with priest and grabbed me. What the fuck, Star? You crazy? He said. You gonna wash your dirty ass in my shower? You never wash your dirty self, Star. Bucky was right. I never showered. I was afraid of getting an infection in my foot as much as I was afraid of getting raped. Those fears kept me perpetually dirty and stinky. But today, I had to shower. My terrible body odor was making it difficult for me and Lauriston to eat in our cell, and I'd forced myself into the stall. I could feel my face turning white at the thought of being beaten, even raped, by Bucky and Priest. I closed my eyes and wished it would end quickly. You can't go in there, Bomba. Open your eyes. Open them and look at me, Bucky yelled. But my eyes remained glued shut, my body stiff as a board. Bucky shouted again, only louder this time. Open your blood clot eyes, Star. You can't go in there, not with your foot wound open like that. Here, Bucky said. I felt something squishy press against my chest. I opened my eyes a crack, careful to protect them from a fist or finger gouge. Bucky was handing me his black jail sandals. You need to wear these to keep your feet off the ground. The bacteria is on the ground. If you step in it, it will get in your wound and you'll lose your foot. As Bucky said that, Priest grabbed my shoulder and added, Turn them over, look. I carried the Star of David on the bottom to protect you against the filth of this place. One, bless. There it was, the Star of David, engraved on the heel, right where my injured foot would rest. When I returned to my cell, Lauriston was there, waiting. I told him what had happened. He just grinned and said, I told you so.